So I'm going to make some sort of more general comments about meaningful use and the interaction of the meaningful use process with syndromic surveillance. So I think this is probably old news for pretty much everybody here, but I think it's important to not forget that the meaningful use legislation or the whole process is about increasing EMR adoption. And many countries around the world have tried to do it. In the United States, this is, I think, a really impressive approach that's underway right now. But the goal is really to get people to use more electronic medical records, primarily in healthcare institutions and for providers. But the twist here in the United States, which is so exciting, is it's not just about using it for anything. It's about using it for very specific objectives, where there's some evidence that there's going to be benefit either by using the EMR for that purpose or using data from the EMR for that purpose. And so that's really what's driving everything right now. And those objectives are coming out in stages. Stage one, as most people know, was released in 2010. Stage two is under consideration right now under review what's going to happen, probably for release in 2013. It'll be another round in 2015. In that first stage that came out, there were a number of objectives that were identified. And, you know, from the initial sort of release to the final rule, there were some changes. In the final rule, what happened was there was a core set of objectives that all software that wants to essentially be certified for the incentives under meaningful use had to ensure that those objectives were met. And then there were some additional objectives that could be selected from. And that's where the public health ones were in phase one. And there are three that most people know about that are listed up here. Obviously, one of them is syndromic surveillance. So, and the mechanism through this which this happens, of course, is that, you know, somebody, either a physician or some other provider or an institution, has to purchase a software that's been accredited, as was mentioned before, to high standards, certified to perform these objectives, and then they get incentive payments, essentially, from CMS, Medicare, Medicaid. So that's the kind of background, just to put it on the same page. So how do these objectives get identified for meaningful use? Well, as I mentioned, there's a huge part of it that is about sort of from the medical or public health side, where is there benefit from these objectives? So there should ideally be some evidence that there's benefit from using an EMR or data from an EMR in this way, and ideally some kind of reasonable amount of consensus amongst users and experts that really this is where we should be putting our money right now. But that really is one side of the equation. And we've also already heard some reference to the other side of the equation, which is, well, what's technically feasible? You can ask for all sorts of great things, and you'd like all sorts of great data. But don't forget, for these objectives we put in place, vendors have to take usually existing software that's been around for a long, long time and modify it to provide the data or the functionality necessary to meet that objective. And it's not just about modifying one piece of software to do something. That software is interoperating with other pieces of software. And so you get this propagation through systems. And so that's why I think examples of asking for one data element might sound simple from a public health perspective, but it may result in a chain of events on the vendor or the health system side that could actually cause a lot of cost and expense. And so that's why there's also a consultation process, quite a lengthy consultation process, organized by the Office of the National Coordinator of Health and Information Technology that goes along prior to turning these objectives or whatever people want to happen into a rule. Obviously, a long period of public comment and an opportunity for expert panel review to weigh in. So that's kind of the big picture in how these objectives come along. One piece that I and ISDS and CDC through the BioSense program has been very involved in is providing the necessary detail around the syndromic surveillance objective. I think there was clear evidence in stage one, or a reasonable consensus in the public health community, this was a good place to put our money in terms of meaningful objectives, meaningful use objectives. But there was a relative paucity of detailed information for vendors as to what they should do with their systems to meet that objective. And so coming out of the Distribute project earlier on in last year, there was a recognition from some of the members of that project that of this problem, that there wasn't really the clarity out there. And so we put in place a process which CDC, through the BioSense program, came in and funded and really helped us to move quite quickly over a 3 to 4 month period to put in place a work group and to try and define what is the current situation in syndromic surveillance, what are the business processes, what are people really doing in health departments right now, and what data they need to get that done. And so that's really what happened. And you can see up on the slide there that just a screenshot of the final recommendation, which is available on the web. And underneath the table, just showing kind of what are those core business processes that people really do with syndromic surveillance. And you know, as it became clear through that work group process, most systems, not all, but most systems and most experiences with data coming out of emergency departments. Either coming as individual messages, as you saw in Julia's example, as was discussed before, or as sort of flat files where, you know, messages are accumulated within a healthcare institution and sent on as a larger file onto a healthcare institution. And so that process was summarized here in the recommendations. And then much of this was handed over to CDC, where they used some of their expertise, again, in conjunction with some of the people that were involved in the recommendations, to put together a messaging guide, which is under development right now. And what that messaging guide does is gives very detailed descriptions to software vendors and others as to, you know, exactly what data elements have to flow to health departments, how should they be encoded, and, you know, in what format they should be in. And so these recommendations of these data elements and the drafts of the messaging guide are under review by ONC right now to try and understand how to go from these recommendations to a final rule for this stage we are right now, meaningful use. Just to give you an example, and I know Julia already mentioned this, but you know, one thing that came out of that process of defining the recommendations and the business processes and the data needed for syndromic surveillance was really how important that free text in the chief complaint field, which is essentially what, when a person comes in the emergency department, they tell the triage nurse in their own words, why are they there? And for most places, that's recorded verbatim, often using abbreviations and other things. But it's highly valuable, and health departments are finding all sorts of innovative ways to search that free text to do exciting sorts of things that Julie was mentioning. But there was an indication amongst participants in the process when we were going through the business process here and looking at the data elements that there's a trend to go away from free text in some systems towards structured data. And there was a session yesterday on this that Charlie Shikawa mentioned where we expanded on this topic a little more. But it was very interesting to see how, you know, transitions in healthcare institutions and in their systems can impact public health without necessarily any communication or coordination there. And I think this spoke very much to the need to have a much, much more of a dialogue, in a sense, between public health and the technical side and in clinical settings. So, you know, I've talked so far, I think, about syndromic surveillance trying to influence the meaningful use process. But the converse is true, too. Through meaningful use process occurring now, it's really starting to influence syndromic surveillance, I think, in at least two ways. One, which is should be evident to most, is there's a potential here to vastly increase the amount of data flowing into public health departments. So far, we've only focused on healthcare institutions with the recommendations that have come out, but eligible providers are also mentioned, and I'll come back to that later. But even just focusing on healthcare institutions, you know, because of the desire to obtain those incentive payments, more and more healthcare institutions will be putting in place electronic medical record systems that will have that feature of sending message-level data, so HL7 messages, to public health departments. So that could produce an awful lot of data, especially for health departments that either don't have a system now or actually receive batch data right now. So there could be quite a change in data quality. And so how are we going to deal with that is, I think, an important issue. It's an opportunity for sure, but it also, as I'll come back to in a second, raises some issues. The other is the need to standardize the process and the data. So, you know, if we're going to give crisp instructions to vendors and healthcare institutions what we want, public health has to have their own act together in terms of being clear about how they use the data and what data elements they need. So, and this is played off, I think, against a very interesting perspective which Julia gave about, you know, well, we're learning how to use these data right now ourselves, and we're looking for innovative and exciting ways to use them. But at the same time, we've got to give a very clear message to the healthcare institutions and to the vendors making the software about exactly what we need and why we need it. And sometimes we're really not in a position for some of the more innovative uses to do that, certainly not with broad community consensus. And so I think this is this is inescapable, this issue right now, because of the way that public health is advancing with their appreciation of these technologies, but it's an important problem to consider. So practically, what are some issues? Well, I mean, one big issue that I was already alluded to before is that none of the meaningful use money is going to public health departments directly. I mean, it's going to providers and healthcare institutions. But public health is being forced to take advantage of this opportunity, go through all sorts of changes. So I understand there are other mechanisms that are trying to be put in place to fund that, but I think this is an important perspective to keep in mind. So obviously we need development of infrastructure in terms of how do you, you know, for health departments that have to start parsing HL7 messages all of a sudden and creating large data warehouses, these are not simple things to do, especially if you don't have people on staff that know how to do them already. And that goes to the human resources side. We really need those kind of skills to deal with these data in a public health department. So, you know, what we really need, and I think this has been alluded to before, is a strategy for receiving and effectively managing large volumes of data in public health settings, either within health departments if the capacities exist, or other alternatives such as has been put forward from the BioSense program, where they can create kind of a catcher's mitt, I think, as Taha's referred to it, where they can essentially provide some of those very valuable services of receiving the messages on behalf of the health department and making them available for the health department and others, perhaps, if the health department wants to share it more broadly. And so that's a very exciting potential direction, I think, that BioSense is going in that could be a great support to public health. So just to finish off some broader issues then. So as I mentioned, the current recommendations focus on, for syndromic surveillance, on healthcare institutions. But I think there is much excitement in public health about the potential of extending syndromic surveillance to eligible providers. So this could mean physicians in the community, for example, sending data from their EMRs. If you think about the number of those outpatient visits that happen, the number of those providers compared to the number of healthcare institutions and their visits, that could be a massive increase in data. Now, just to be clear, it's unlikely that in the current or the next round of meaningful use that there will be a requirement for providers to send under meaningful use as opposed to institutions, but it could be there in the third phase and possibly in the second, unlikely possible. So, you know, how are we going to get there from where we are right now? Obviously, there are some infrastructure issues, but I think even more pressing is the business case. How will we use those data for ambulatory care visits in public health? I think there is some experience around the country and around the world, but not widespread experience. And I think we have to start working very hard to build a cogent argument about why we need those data, for what purposes, and think about the infrastructures to how they'll be handled. At the same time, I think this whole process of meaningful use and interfaces with public health gives us the opportunity to think more broadly about the public health clinical care interface in a very fundamental way. And, you know, I have a concern to some extent that the way we're going now is we're building these digital silos, very specific pipes for very specific purposes, but a number of those pipes from clinical settings to public health. And I think it's important not to keep adding yet another pipe into clinical settings going to public health, because there's only so much capacity there for that. And this, I think, speaks as well to the point that I raised before about having our systems speak to each other. And so, you know, I realize this is sort of a vision a bit farther off, but I think it's important to have a discussion about, you know, what would we like that interface to look like if we were to sort of design towards it in the future, as opposed to just rapidly adding new things one after the other. And then there are also the, you know, sort of more radical alternatives potentially, some of which are already being put forward as sort of trial balloons in a sense by ONC and their Query Health project. Do we need clinical sites to push data to public health, or could we actually do distributed queries out to clinical sites? Now, there's obviously all sorts of technical challenges there, but that's another possibility. And that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, David. Yeah. So with that, I mean, we'll be happy to start taking your questions. Okay. Aaron.
Bless you. I just wanted to make a couple comments. Really interesting presentations, and I think a lot of interesting forethought is being put out there. But I want to talk a little bit about what I'm doing now. And it is in sharp contrast in some cases, when we hear about really great ideas that we should be thinking about and working toward. But If I bring out some examples of just this week or last week speaking with vendors, large national vendors who we would all know if I were to name them, they're telling me in the current list of data elements that we're requesting that are in the ISDS guide and also in the draft implementation guide. So there's one issue of most of the clinical variables, even the discharge diagnosis or discharge disposition, which we currently receive in our pre-standard formats that we receive in Florida, they're telling us that they don't have the ability to provide that. And so in some instances, it's not across the board, our data quality would actually go down if we choose to receive their HL7 message, 2.3.1 or 2.5.1, as opposed to our flat file that we get through SFTP n times a day or whatever. We hope that this will obviously be alleviated over time. I don't have a good sense of that. They're also, you know, as this conversation unfolds over the phone, I hear, well, this is going to cost the hospital much more if we have to make this change, and there's lots of back and forth about the vendor wanting to approach their customer about implementing this. So my sense is that in order for meaningful use to occur really well, particularly in the ways that are being presented, hospitals themselves have to find a better way to meaningfully exchange their own data internally. Once that can happen, then it can be used meaningfully outside of the hospital context and in public health. So the issue here is ED data versus inpatient data versus lab data. These are often different systems within one hospital, and they don't talk to each other. So how can we say, okay, we want ED chief complaint, XYZ demographics, discharge diagnosis, temperature? Well, those are things that occur in many different places within one system, and the vendor product that we're interfacing with doesn't reach in to get them all. So just some practical issues that we're dealing with. We hope that we can get by them over time. We'll see, and we hope our data quality doesn't go down as a result, at least in the short term. Thank you.
David, do you want to take it first?
Well, I'll just say quickly, I think that was what I was trying to talk about in the context of, you know, understanding what's happening in healthcare institutions. We ask for variables in public health, and, you know, I think you might have more to say on this from your perspective, but, you know, I think the data do exchange in the health institution for the reasons the health institution wants. They didn't necessarily build it, though, thinking about what public health wants. And so now we're coming into the game in a way we haven't been before and making requests. And I think it's natural to expect it's going to take a bit of time for the healthcare institutions to be able to reconfigure their systems to meet our needs in addition to their needs.
Yeah, you were speaking to the issue that I mentioned, that you probably can't create these messages with your current interface engine. You're probably going to have to go back to the vendor. The advantage that we have, and it is longer rather than short term, is that meaningful use is going to drive the vendors to figure out a way to do this, because the incentives are tremendous from the hospital's point of view to go back to their vendor and say, we need to be able to do this by this date. And that often motivates the vendors very nicely. If you're doing internal development, it's actually very straightforward.
I mean, how the whole syndromic surveillance in stage one came about, I mean, there was about a couple of trials before we really landed on these recommendations. So right now it's not set in the rule what these elements are. ONC is currently reviewing the 32 elements. It might not be 32, it might be, those might be broken into core and maybe optional, and have some of the providers weigh in a little bit on that. But we'll see how it is. We'll phase out for stage two when it becomes the rule, and then the incentive is more clear for the providers to provide this information. From our experience in BioSense, yes, this position, for example, I mean, some elements, and we looked at all the elements and say what is realistic, what's not. For example, pulse oximetry, I mean, almost there's nobody's reporting that to BioSense over the last decade. Temperature, there are a few subset of that, but then when we correlate that with you know, measure temperature, accurate measure temperature against someone who's saying they have or don't have fever, actually fever was more accurate or more of an indicator than measure temperature. So do we need measure temperature? So, I mean, we have to also do that homework based on other things, other sources that we have. But we're in discussion right now with ONC. Hopefully we'll come up with some realistic minimum and then make it more clear for stage two and beyond.
I think one of the things we often forget about in this dialogue is if we're not working towards this kind of electronic exchange, there is information that must be sent to public health, and then the choice may be paper and people on the hospital's end, and that can be an enormous cost that the vendor's clients then may be having to occur. And that's going to be the part of the reality that should be thought about as we move into these discussions, because it's not just about the software, the transmission of information. There is information that is required. And sometimes it can have a very negative impact on healthcare institutions. And we have had experiences in Boston where outbreaks were not timely reported by hospitals. And it actually ended up on the media. And that's not a good situation for a hospital or a healthcare institution to be involved in.
Mike?
No.
No,
I had a question.
Walter. What's up with my, Walter and then Mike.
I'll tell you. All right. I'm Walter Suarez. I'm with Kaiser Permanente and the Public Health Data Standards Consortium. I wanted to make a comment about the comment that was made earlier, because I think while the transition from a flat file to an HL7 standard is a big transition, I'm not sure where the challenge is, whether it's in the provider end migrating their flat file submission to public health syndromic surveillance systems to HL7, or from the receiver end, the syndromic surveillance systems migrating their capability to receive a flat file to an HL7 fly, or both. It could be both. But the reality is, from a provider perspective, thinking of that side, on the one hand, we're required now to use HL7 standard for several of these exchanges, you know, under meaningful use and the standard requirements. And while, yes, it is going to be some work to create or migrate the whatever current flat file formatting is being done to submit today the data to an HL7 standard, it's going to be something that we're going to have to do for many other messages, because that's what meaningful use requires to do. So from the provider end, we are going to want to migrate to a common single transaction standard rather than having multiple types of transactions, and whether flat files or other formats, and then HL7 on top of it, and HL7 231 and HL7 251 and then CDA and all these various versions. You know, it's going to be a lot more costly for us to try to support and continue supporting all those versions. So from that perspective, the provider end is going to want to migrate to a common single transaction standard. From the, you know, syndromic surveillance system receiving end, yes, there's going to be some transition to happen as well, and migrating to a HL7 251 will be a major transition too. But I'm wondering, I don't quite understand why, if the data is already being sent on a flat file, why can't the data be sent in an HL7 transaction now that the data is already, you know, being captured and collected? So while there is some arguments about, well, you know, pulling all this data in the implementation guide that is being proposed from multiple systems creates a question about whether internally those systems communicate themselves to generate the message at the end. Yeah, that's a question, but that's also a reality that we are, you know, going to have to deal with, because those internal systems have to talk to each other And migrating those internal systems to a common standard like HL7251 will allow that communication internally to happen. So internally, from a provider perspective, we're going to want to go again to a common standard, and we're certainly very much supportive of the concept of moving in that direction. There is going to be, again, a transition, but we're going to have to do it because all the other systems, all the other transactions we have to do are going to go in that new national standard. So I just wanted to make that comment because I'm not sure why vendors would come back and tell people, well, we don't have that data or we can't do that transaction. If those vendors are being certified to offer EHR products to clinics and hospitals, and by being certified they have to comply with the standards that are being named by ONC, then, you know, they have to support those and they have to be able to communicate those. Maybe, again, not today, but the transition will, you know, have to happen and they'll have to migrate there. So just thought of making some comments from that perspective.
Oh. Thank you. We appreciate that. I mean, there's a challenge also on the public health side. I mean, there are those who currently conduct, I mean, syndromic surveillance is not mandated by law, for example. So those who conduct syndromic surveillance in health departments are currently doing it in a way that most of them is a flat file. To go and upgrade to HL7, and that's a huge undertaking. Also, the opportunity where you have about 2/3 of the health department in the country that may wish to, I mean, as we're working, for example, in Boston's redesign with the CSDE now, so there's a lot of health departments never conducted syndromic surveillance, would love to do something like this, but they don't have the capacity to do it. And that's part of what addressing the captures meant in Biosense 2.0, however. But, I mean, it's a huge undertaking on the public health side, but yeah, we'd agree, you know, from your perspective. Now, the rule is right now is only 231 or 251. I mean, hopefully in stage two, then it will be really clear, 251, and we endorse going to 251 from provider side. But until then, what can we do so we don't lose the opportunity, especially a lot of incentives going out this year? So,
thank you, guys, for great presentations. And I just wanted to highlight the
Mike
previous.
Mike Coletta, by yourself.
Sorry, Mike Coletta with NACHO. I just wanted to highlight the previous conversation and the previous session that I had with Howard and Sean Granis. You know, they were presenting on what they've done with syndromic data, and there were two things that struck me that I think have bearing on this conversation. One, Howard was talking about the complexities of the data and how much data he was using. Biosense kind of deep data, lot of data that doesn't necessarily exist in all systems, but he was showing real value in all of that data, which not this type of research there's not a lot of that kind of research out there. And when I asked him the question, well, we're talking about potentially reducing what we get, he said, well, you might want to rethink that. It's some valuable data that we need, right? So I just want to throw that out there. And then Sean asked Howard a question about LOINC codes, because in the study he did, there was one particular LOINC code that they used, and he said, you know, there's like 15 of these LOINC codes, and what we find is that people aren't even using the LOINC codes right, so then we have to use free text to figure all this stuff out, right? And there's this big, huge push, standards, but they're not really standards. So I want to throw that into the mix, because I feel like people are just making assumptions that aren't true. So I think we need to carefully consider these things as quickly as we can, because I understand there's a short time frame, and we want to, but we have to put a little thought into these things, I think. So.
That's a great point, and I think that's what I was trying to say in my presentation about, you know, we're in this zone right now where the evidence isn't always clear about how we're going to use all that data, but there's an intuition and there are good anecdotes about how we can use them. But I think that the pressure's on in the public health practice and research community to really build a clear and compelling argument for those data so that we can, you know, we have something to stand behind when we're going into the next rounds of meaningful use and we're trying to be very specific about the data element and not be the data hoarder that Julie referred to.
And the other thing is, it's not just making the use case, but understanding the tools that need to be available to support the use of some of those data elements. So I can bring anything in, but do I then have the capacity to take a radiographic report and characterize it. And when you look at a lot of radiographic reports for especially like chest x-rays, you know, there'll be a little tiny granuloma, which might be an indication of prior exposure to tuberculosis. But radiologists tend to write, cannot rule out tuberculosis. So I think there's a lot of struggles as we begin to move forward. What are the right tools? What are the right classifications? And how can we maximize the utility? I think Howard's doing some really fascinating work, but can all of us collectively begin to use it? And then that also translates into training for workforce. We heard a lot about the need for people with informatics background, database architecture, messaging experience, but we also need to train our workforce on how to use this data. This is vastly different. This is not anything that's taught in school. Surveillance is like it's less than a stepchild in schools of public health. And so how do we begin to retool the workforce for the 21st century? It's not necessarily about epidemiology, that classic framework, but really people that can look at surveillance data and make decisions and move it to the next step for action. And that's a huge void. And for those of us, and I know, Mike, you have experiences, we spend a lot of time training people who have absolutely no idea what this whole field is about.
Yes. No, there's a lot of them.
Hi, Hua Ganchen from New York State Department of Health. I have to echo what Aaron said. I think it's not the data format issue, it's the data source. We currently in New York State receive over 140 ED data from the hospitals, and most of them are flat files, and they are coming from the nurse triage system. And right now we are working with one of the HIE in New York State, we call Regional Health Information Organization, and that the data they get from the hospital are ADT messages. And so right now we have the data come from the hospital to Rio and from Rio to the state, and this is real-time ADT messages. And then we find out the data from point A to point B and to point C is not the same data from point A to point C. So we are looking into that, why they are not the same. But it's not the HR7 issue, it's the data source issue. And the other thing is, ADT message may be different. I don't know where they're coming from. Maybe it's not from nurse triage system. And we found out ADT, we have more missing chief complaint. And so I think the data quality issue is a big issue. If we are looking at the stage one, we can say certify for meaningful use, but they are not really meaningful for state to use. So we are trying to say if we want to certify for syndromic, we want to be the data in production, not just for meaningful use.
Thank you. I think that's a really important point. As a person who has been a triage nurse in an emergency room department, the demographic is sort of the age, the dates of birth, the age, the zip codes, some the gender. That's actually coming out of usually the registration system. Chief complaints come usually out of another system. There may be variations in your hospitals, the way they're structured and where information is housed, and I think it's going to become incumbent on public health to begin to understand these systems. They're really different in hospitals than in a lot of the provider offices. There are a lot of big systems that have to interface with each other in the hospital. That's been my experience. So there's a radiology system, there's a laboratory system, there's a clinical observation system, and that's where a lot of your vital signs, your chief complaints, your triage notes are. There's administrative systems for registration and billing purposes, and information is housed in various points. So I think it's also going back to the the provider and understanding where that information sits in their system. So as Bob has pointed out, some of it is the what's about the patient is in one system. What's about the clinical observation terms is going to be pulled from usually another system.
Hi, my name is Dina Passman. I'm an epidemiologist with the Fusion Cell at the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response at HHS. And so this question, I guess, is for anyone out there, but specifically for Ms. Gunn, which is when you're talking about new data sources and syndromic surveillance, how do we, or what's Boston's position and then maybe your position on the use of social media data for public health situational awareness? Do you have guidelines? Do you have policies? Is this something that you're contemplating it, or is it not, it's not a low hanging fruit. I know that for sure based on our work with it. So how do you think this links into the work that you're doing? Your work is more similar to ours because you're on the crux of response. I know you deal with the emergency response part, so I'd just be interested in hearing your take.
We see social media as part of our surveillance strategies, and we're going to be working with our information offices because they are big users of social media in Boston. And we're often using social media to inform our constituents about activity. And when we look at surveillance, I'm looking at this as also not only what people are talking about, but how does that diverge from what we're seeing in disease? Not all events are caused by morbidity, but more by social anxiety. And we also need to get ahead of the game for that. And rumor control is incredibly valuable in this process. And so we often feedback information of what we're seeing or what we're hearing about to our communications office. They often tell us what's the chatter out there because they're really monitoring and they're actively Twittering, putting things on Facebook. They have dialogues going on with youth. They're bloggers. They love this stuff. And so they're hearing things, and then they come back to us and say, are you seeing anything about this? We provide them with information. The other thing that we do is we also use syndromic surveillance to assess what's happening in our emergency room departments and then look to see how well we're doing. So, for example, about a year ago, a major water main broke, and we had to go to boil water. It was a big pipe. It's like 10 feet across. And so there was, you know, bottled water, media came. But immediately what we did is we created a syndrome to look for people coming in that said, you know, I drank the water. I'm sick from the water. To really assess how well we were getting the message out, because in the tight time frame, it was unlikely to be causing disease. We've also had experiences where media reports of injuries or medical conditions by famous people generate emergency room department visits. This has been well described. They saw it in New York City after Bill Clinton had his angioplasty. We've seen similar events in Boston. And one example was after Teddy Bruschi, who was a Patriots player right after they won the Super Bowl. He's in his late 20s, I believe, at the time, had a stroke. And it scared men in their 20s and 30s. And now we were seeing them going to emergency room departments saying, I have the worst headache of my life. They weren't having strokes. But it was also an opportunity for public health to engage the public about prevention strategies for strokes. So we see this as a dynamic dialogue with communications that's informing surveillance and then providing feedback to communications, who is then getting the message out and telling us also what's going on. And they do a lot of monitoring on, you know, what social media is telling us about what people are talking about in Boston and the greater Boston area.
Mike's question a little while ago reminded me of one of Charlie Ishikawa's discussion questions yesterday, when he said, why is there this inertia pushing toward the pick list as opposed to the, and I was thinking about that afterwards, and I think it generalizes to a bigger question here. And I think that inertia, afterwards I was thinking, if I put myself in the position of a developer, I'm going to want to do the simplest thing. The trouble is the developers are trying to serve such a wide variety of needs. And having worked on BioSense collaborations lately, you keep coming to each problem, well, you need this kind of information, and that's not in there. And another problem, you need this kind of information, and that's not in there. So I think it's really important in this meaningful use discussion to get as much input as the type of needs there are, because otherwise this inertia for the pick lists is going to be also very much in effect for the bigger meaningful use problems and the more general meaningful use problems. And I just wanted to stress that. After yesterday, I can very easily see what it looks like from the other side.
But there's one other group that we need to include in that, and that's the patients. And populations describe illness in many ways, and oftentimes we take what they're telling us and we make assumptions about what they're telling us, and we put that square peg in a round hole, and sometimes it's not a real good fit, and sometimes it can actually be a fatal fit because we don't know what they're really telling us. And oftentimes in our tuberculosis clinic, we're actually working with three translators because we have people that only speak dialogues. And so I, as the nurse, will say, do you have a cough? And I ask David. And he goes off and has this long conversation with someone in French. And then that person then asks the patient in another language. And then they have this long dialogue. And then they come back to me through this chain and they say, no. Well, there's a lot of nuances because I know there was a lot, you could feel the clarifications that are going on because he's like, no, no, no. And we've lost a lot and we may be making very wrong associations. And I've looked at millions of chief complaints and there's one I've never seen and it's called Done Fell Out. And that's a southern one. It's not in Boston. And if somebody came to our emergency room departments and said, Dunn fell out, I don't know what they would code it like as a pick list. And if I was the triage nurse, I might think they were talking about a fall. And it's not, it's a syncopal episode. And so I think we need to spend some time with what people are telling us about their conditions because it may not fit nicely into a pick list because that's really what this is about. And pick lists are really nice for technology. They may be really bad for clinical care because people won't pay attention to them because they won't be effective.
Yeah, I'd like to reinforce that. An awful lot of the useful, clinically useful information in an EHR is in the text. It's in the notes. If you were to go look, particularly in the outpatient arena, at those diagnosis codes, et cetera, that they put in for billing, they're not really very descriptive. And yet they're often the thing that when you aggregate, everybody looks at. So, to the extent that you have any influence or you are a developer, keep the text in addition to the pick list because there's a lot of richness in that text and you want to have that still available for analysis. There's some very interesting text analysis tools coming online that have just been developed and released in the last year or two, and it'll be very interesting to see what abilities that they have. But even without them, we still have the ability as humans to look at them, and some of us are talented enough to be able to extract from those in a way they can codify, which I think is probably the essence of this job.
I think that's what I was, this issue is kind of what I was trying to refer to as well in the context of the free text chief complaint work that we did before. And I think it fundamentally comes down to, you know, if you're trying to take a long discourse and reduce it to a code, you know, there may be a way to do that that makes perfect sense in the context of the triage process. But is that coding going to retain the same information needed by a public health person or in a health department? And so I think that's it's part of the issue here is that, you know, what do you take from all that discussion and reduce to a single code for all the multiple users of the data? And the person sitting in front of the system and coding it right there is not thinking about all those other users. They're thinking about their use. And so I think that is exactly the strategy that probably is going to make the most sense. In this particular example, is sure, assign a code, but don't lose the text, because then users later on can go back to that source text and code it in different ways that make sense for them.
Do you have additional questions from the audience here? Maybe asking the one person on the conference call. All right, well, thank you so much. Really appreciate your time today. Thanks.
Thank you.